I am certain in closing that this forum will be inspirational in eliciting solutions to this complex and pressing problem of access to essential medications around the world. With guests representing civil society organizations, academic institutions, and the United Nations, and coming from Australia, Argentina, India, South Africa, the United States, the United Kingdom, Belgium, Switzerland, and Canada, I am certain that this forum will be rich in exchanges and in finding creative solutions for the problem under scrutiny. I wish you all an excellent forum and a most pleasant stay in Montreal. Bienvenue à l'Université de Montréal.
Merci, Renaldo. Et j'aimerais d'abord annoncer quelques changements, quelques modifications dans le programme de la soirée. Deux personnes qui ont été annoncées, Jim Yong Kim de l'Organisme mondial de la santé et Stephen Lewis, ne peuvent pas être parmi nous ce soir. Ils ont été amplement remplacés par Alexander Capron de l'OMS. Et Stephen Lewis, il n'y a pas de remplacement, mais notre panel est très, très, très capable de mener le débat. Alors, nous excusons pour ça, mais on aura un peu plus de temps pour écouter chacun de nos présentateurs. I'll keep my opening remarks as brief as possible and sometimes bilingual, so you shouldn't need the earphones. But just to tell you about the order of sort of the program for the night, it's going to be, the program se déroule en trois temps. Premièrement, il y aura la table ronde. Deuxièmement, le lancement de la revue Global Health Watch. Et ensuite, une réception à laquelle vous êtes tous invités. And the roundtable is also going to take place in three phases. The first is one of individual presentations. So we'll hear from our participants on the five questions that you will have in the program in front of you. Why do so many people lack access to essential medicines? What can and should be done to improve the situation? Who bears what responsibilities in this regard? What, if anything, do human rights have to do with these responsibilities? And what, if anything, do national and international public institutions have to do with these responsibilities? After that, we will have a period of exchange where Alexander Capron will take the lead in posing questions to the panelists, and there'll be an opportunity for exchange among them. And after that, there'll be a time for you to ask questions, and we hope you do so. And so that's the structure of the roundtable. And it's now a pleasure for me to introduce our first speaker. Oh, the speaking order is Thomas Paga, James Orbinski, Carlos Correa, and Thomas Paga. And it's a pleasure to introduce, first of all, Thomas, who's a good friend, but I think I have to read now his more formal biography. So Thomas is a political philosopher whose work focuses on global justice, and in particular on the analysis of moral responsibility for the alleviation of global poverty and for the fulfillment of human rights. Since receiving his PhD in philosophy from Harvard under the supervision of John Rawls, who is often thought to be the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, Thomas Paga has been teaching moral and political philosophy and Kant at Columbia University. A prolific writer, he's the author of the landmark World Poverty and Human Rights, Cosmopolitan Responsibilities and Reforms, which is now being translated into German, Swedish, Spanish, Turkish, Brazilian Portuguese, and Mandarin Chinese. His work has been supported by several foundations, most recently by the John and Catherine MacArthur Foundation, the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study, All Souls College at Oxford, the National Institutes of Health, the U.S. National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, and he is currently Professorial Research Fellow at the Australian National University Center for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. Welcome, Thomas.
Wonderful. I don't, despite all of that, get extra time, so I've just divided my time into two little units because what I will say fits best a little bit at the beginning and a little bit at the end. So I wanted to start by giving you a tiny bit of background about the global poverty problem, which is essentially one of the main roots of the problem that we will discuss here this weekend. What you have here is the latest facts and figures about the deprivations that are caused by global poverty. And you can see that the problem is a very large problem relative to the existing world population. Very large segments of the human population suffer quite severe deprivations, including severe health problems. Perhaps the most shocking statistic of all concerns the death toll from poverty-related causes, which amounts to roughly one-third of all deaths. That number is higher than most of you expect, because among the poor in the human population, many more than a proportional number of deaths occur. The poor live shorter lifespans, and so the turnover, if you like, among the poor is much higher than the turnover among richer populations. So of something like 57 million deaths annually, about 18 million are due to poverty-related causes, most of those affecting children under 5 years of age. These are from the WHO, the statistics, and you can see there that many of these premature deaths are caused by various kinds of diseases for which medicines could be at least a partial solution. Putting this in perspective, I'm comparing this 18 million figure, 18 million premature deaths per year, with all the deaths that happened over the 20th century caused by government-sponsored violence, either wars or civil wars or government repression such as concentration camps, gulags, and so on. And you can see that even at the height of the Second World War, these deaths never reached anywhere near 18 million. They reached about 8.2 million deaths per year. So right now, today, many more people die of poverty-related causes than died of violence, even at the height of the Second World War. Same point once more in terms of the grand total. Since the end of the Cold War, roughly 16 years ago, 300 million people have died from poverty-related causes, and that dwarfs the total number of deaths, excess deaths, caused by the Second World War. And actually, it dwarfs the number of all the deaths caused by all the wars, all the civil wars, all government repression of the entire 20th century, which amounted to roughly 200 million. Now, this gives you a sense of the economic background of poverty. And these are statistics that are developed by the World Bank. Basically, the World Bank maintains two different poverty lines, the $1 a day and $2 a day poverty lines. The $2 a day poverty line is on the right, and that's the one that interests me in the moment. You see there that almost half of all human beings live below $2 a day. And you also see that that poverty line today corresponds to an annual consumption expenditure in the United States of $1,062 per person per year. So the poverty line is very, very low. You're using purchasing power parities to convert it into national currency. And nonetheless, something like 44% of all human beings live below even that low poverty line. Final slide. To put that in perspective, look at this pie chart. You see here that the people living below that poverty line, the poorest households, 43.5% of all human beings, together have about 1.2% of the global social product, compared to about 80.4% for the affluent countries together, who represent 15.5% of the entire human population. Now, if we think about the grand total of premature deaths and all these deprivations, I want to highlight three causal factors that together, I think, go a very long way towards explaining that problem. One is poverty, which I've highlighted before. Poverty is a major factor in causing disease, and it's also a major factor in explaining why people succumb to disease, because they have no access to remedies to the diseases that they have. A second factor is the fact that access to essential drugs, essential medicines, is regulated through the price mechanism. And a third factor is that the price level for essential medicines is as high as it is. All these three factors together, I think, go a long way towards explaining the great degree of deprivation and death. And all three factors, of course, are very much under human control, very much influenced in particular by the social rules and social institutions, both at the national and the global level.
The next speaker, I think, so that we don't, we'll have concentrated applause at the end, if that's okay. And the next speaker is Dr. James Orbinski, who is a research scientist at St. Michael's Hospital and associate professor of family and community medicine, public health sciences, and political science at the University of Toronto. He's also a senior fellow at both Massey College and the Monk Centre for International Studies, also at the University of Toronto. Dr. Orbinski is the past international president of Médecins Sans Frontières and past international president of MSF's Drugs for Neglected Diseases Working Group, which created the global not-for-profit research and development initiative that seeks to develop drugs for the most neglected diseases of the developing world. Dr. Orbinski has extensive field experience with MSF. He was MSF's head of mission in Zaire in the fall of 1996 during the refugee crisis. He was the head of mission in Kigali during the Rwandan genocide in 1994 and medical coordinator in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, also in the winter of 1994. He was MSF's medical coordinator in Somalia during the civil war and famine of 1992 to 93. He accepted the 1999 Nobel Peace Prize awarded to Médecins Sans Frontières for its humanitarian work and advocacy since 1971. And he is currently president of Dignitas International, an NGO conducting community-based intervention research and HIV/AIDS care in Malawi. Welcome,
great.
James.
Thank you, Mira. This public forum is trying in some way to address five questions. Why do so many people still lack access to essential medicines? What can and should be done to improve the situation? Who bears what responsibilities in this regard? And what, if anything, do human rights have to do with these responsibilities? And then finally, what, if anything, do national and international public institutions have to do with these responsibilities? What I'd like to do over the next few minutes is paint a broad stroke picture of access to essential medicines and within a broader stroke picture of human rights over the 20th century, and where those two critical issues intersect. And I'd also like, at the end of my brief few minutes, to essentially pose a challenge to the human rights community to adopt a different approach to human rights advocacy. Now, what Thomas has just done is he's told us a little bit about the world as it is. And one of the figures that he pointed out was that 18 million people die every year of largely preventable preventable communicable diseases. Well, let me just tell you about one person that I met in 1999 who was a victim, if you will, of that reality. It was a 20-year-old young man, I should say, in South Africa. And he was dying of AIDS and was brought to an MSF clinic in Khayelitsha with a profound pneumonia that left him weak, unable to walk on his own, and to the extent that he required two people, his mother and his sister, to help carry him into the to the clinic and help put him on the examining table. Now, his pneumonia was so severe that there was a foul odor from his every breath. And that foul odor was so profound that one of the nurses in the examining room actually had to leave the examining room to vomit outside the examining room door. Now, that young man, as I examined him with Eric Gomar, who is the head of mission for MSF in Khayelitsha, or who was the head of mission, I should say, for MSF in Khayelitsha. That young man said to me, asked me a set of questions that I think are profound, are practical, and were, in his formulation, an impassioned plea around the reality of the injustice that he faced. I'm just going to read you exactly what he said to me. He said, "Why do you come here with kindness when what I need is medicine to stop this AIDS? Your kindness is good, but it will not stop this AIDS. They have such medicines in your countries. Why not here in South Africa for people like me?" Now that set of questions, in my mind, gets to the heart of what the issues gets to the heart of the issues that we're trying to address, I think, in this conference, and that have been addressed in various ways over the last 7 or 8 years by a number of actors, and I'm going to talk about that. But let me just point out that right now, as we speak, one-third or one in every three people on the planet have no access to life-saving essential medicines. And that doesn't mean partial access or incomplete access or sometime access, but absolutely no access to life-saving medicines for the many of the reasons that that Thomas talked about. And in Africa, that number goes up to 50%. And in some parts of Asia as well, that number is as high as 50%. Now, this conference is about health and human rights. And it's particularly about the question, is there a right to access essential medicines? Well, let's just for a second look at human rights. The human rights have become, in a way, core values of the moral, of the modern moral and political discourse. And they've become central to how justice is conceived in the modern world. And yet, human rights are not simply a legalistic guide to justice. They represent in legal form centuries-long interpersonal and intercultural understandings of human dignity. And they also represent a codification, if you will, of the understanding of mutuality that exists between us as human beings. And these basic concepts of dignity and human rights are both before politics and, in fact, after politics. And in some circumstances, these concepts are placed at the center of politics by political design. And in the around the issue of access to essential medicines, the one country that I can think of that has done this in the most profound and practical way is Brazil. These concepts are also placed in the center, if you will, of the political project or the political debate by those who act to challenge political power. And that's actually what civil society organizations have done in large measure over the last 7 to 8 years in terms of challenging the power of the pharmaceutical industry and challenging largely the power of the American government and the EU in terms of their explicit support for the interests of the pharmaceutical industry. Now, contemporary notions of human rights in the form of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, 1948 UN Declaration of Human Rights, emerged in the wake of two world wars that fought over the ideological struggles between communism, fascism, and capitalism, and also against the totalitarianism, if you will, of what a triumph of a single one of these ideologies would mean. Those wars left Europe and much of the rest of the world decimated. And from this, the Keynesian state was born, the idea which in a nutshell is the idea that the market is embedded in society and not that society is embedded in the market. Now, the Keynesian state survived through the third great war of the 20th century, which of course was the Cold War. And when the Cold War ended, we've seen the steady triumph of a neoliberal ideology that in fact embeds society in the market rather than the market in society. And so the questions that concern this conference can be seen in this historic perspective. And the questions that matter now is, very simply, do human rights matter in claiming the right of all people to access essential medicines? Well, you may be surprised to know that there, in fact, is no perfect answer to that question. But in the events of the last 7 or 8 years, These events are, in fact, highly instructive in that they show us that we must, in fact, struggle with that question, and not simply in the abstract or in technical legal terms, but in the practical application of the question around specific issues. Now, in the last 7 years, enormous progress has been made in the struggle to ensure access to essential medicines. And that struggle has been informed by a global activism that has been critical, that has been, in fact, the critical force in terms of altering the discourse and in terms of altering the reality around access to essential medicines. Now, that activist force has been made up of a legion of activists in non-government organizations, for example, like CPTech, Partners in Health, Treatment Access Campaign in South Africa, Access Campaign in Thailand, Health Action International, Oxfam, and of course, Médecins Sans Frontières. It's also been made up of activists within institutions like the WHO. It's also been made up of activists within governments, and it's also been made up of activists within academia who have participated in this broad coalition that has become a powerful global force in terms of affecting notions and conceptions of human rights and notions and conceptions of the duties of states to ensure access to healthcare and specifically access to essential medicines. Now, essentially, all of this has taken place largely since 1999, when MSF launched its Access to Essential Medicines campaign. That was the galvanizing force that brought all of these activists together around a set of core principled ideas. Now, as well, central to the activities of the last 7 years has been the reality of the AIDS epidemic, or the AIDS pandemic, I should say. It's been absolutely central to the struggle that's been waged over the last few years. And it has been used as a wedge issue by this coalition to draw attention to a broader set of issues around access to essential medicines for other neglected diseases like African sleeping sickness, trypanosomiasis, leishmaniasis, borrelia ulcer, and so on and so on and so on. Now, what's happened is that in the context of the AIDS epidemic and in the context of this broad coalition, a broad range of issues have been specifically addressed, the first being access to existing medicines, the second being overcoming trade barriers to health, and the third being ensuring research and development for neglected diseases. Now, before I detail the specific activities and accomplishments in each of those three areas, let me just say that for the AIDS epidemic, human rights and notions of human rights were central to advancing new conceptions of public health and the practice of public health around the containment and control of the epidemic. And this was true in the early phases of the epidemic. In 1986, for example, there was a resolution brought to the World Health Assembly that argued that discrimination against people who are HIV positive has a profound impact on the viability of public health programs that seek to contain and control the HIV epidemic. And in the words of Jonathan Mann, at that time, it was an effort that refused discrimination, and it led to major changes in how public health defines itself and how a new movement, which links health and human rights inextricably together. So the first human rights issue, if you will, taken on within the AIDS pandemic was the issue of discrimination against people who are HIV positive. The second major issue was a deeper recognition of the lack of respect for human rights and how that leads to increased vulnerability of people to become infected with HIV. So the first was about discrimination against people who are HIV positive, and then the second was a recognition of the lack of respect for human rights that create vulnerabilities for people to become infected with HIV. These two critical human rights notions were core, if you will, to changes in public health practice and public health discourse from roughly the mid-80s right up until roughly the mid-90s. Now, then, in some mysterious way, in my view, human rights discourse suddenly failed to participate actively in the pursuit of access to essential medicines and in the pursuit of access to health care. But in the absence of a significant, and I'm not saying completely absent, but in the absence of a significant human rights discourse around access to essential medicines from the mid-90s on, activism and of the kind that I described earlier has led to major changes over the last 7 years. And they are significant, they're also imperfect. And so, for example, around access to existing medicines, we've seen the price of antiretrovirals fall from roughly $15,000 per patient per year for patented medications to less than $200 per patient per year for generic versions of those same medicines. We've also seen increased availability of drugs like DFMO, for example, for African sleeping sickness. We've also seen increased availability of drugs like capreomycin for the treatment of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. And we've also seen the creation of innovative models for the disbursement of drugs, like the Green Light Committee for MDR-TB at the WHO. In terms of trade barriers, in terms of overcoming existing trade barriers and their impact on access to medicines, what we've seen over the last 7 years or so is a collapse, significantly, of the case of 39 pharmaceutical companies in South Africa that was brought against the South African government. And that case was not tried in court, but in fact was tried in the court of public opinion, of global public opinion. We've also seen the Doha Declaration, which some of you may be familiar with. And essentially, this is a declaration that was made by the World Trade Organization and its TRIPS Council, which said that public health interests essentially must trump trade interests, and that it is the responsibility of governments to pursue, to promote, and to protect the public interest, and also to define what is the public interest. And that text, the Doha Declaration, led to another text called the MATA text, which allows for the export of generic versions of patented medications to countries that don't have a manufacturing capacity. And that's led to legislation, for example, here in Canada, like Bill C-9, and to similar legislation in India that allows for generic production of a medication for export. In terms of R&D, in terms of stimulating R&D, what we've seen is a flourishing of public-private partnerships. For example, the Global Alliance for TB Drug Development, IAVI, MMV, and the MSF-created initiative that Mira referred to, the DNDI, or the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative. We've also seen a movement called the Access to Knowledge Movement, largely focused on activities at WIPO, that seek new and innovative approaches to innovation, to human rights, and to development. And we've also seen, as well, the creation of the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria. And we've also seen, finally, a reinvigorated WHO that has taken active responsibility and active leadership in the pursuit of public health programs and practice around access to essential medicines, and particularly around HIV. That was a long time coming, and this civil society movement played a key role in pushing the WHO to actively assume its responsibility. Now, one of the activists who was a key player in Partners in Health that was involved in redesigning, if you will, the approach to multidrug-resistant tuberculosis by the WHO DOTS program, he is now one of the key people inside WHO in terms of running WHO's 3x5 program. And there are others, Herman Velasquez and many other people inside the WHO who've played a critical activist role in terms of advancing the interests of that institution. Now, I want to argue that what activism has been doing over the last seven or so years is, in fact, moving beyond, well beyond, human rights claims to avoid, for example, discrimination of HIV-positive people, and moving beyond and well beyond using human rights claims to decrease the vulnerability of people to HIV infection. And these two notions are essentially support, in my view, an institutionally passive role that sees human rights simply as a set of individual entitlements. And this activist movement, in fact, has moved to one that makes moral claims on institutions and demands that these institutions change their roles to proactively enable the realization of human rights. Now, as I said a moment ago, human rights, oddly enough, have not actually been central to the arguments or to the actions of this movement over the last 7 years. They have been important, and I'm not saying they're unimportant, but they have played largely a supportive role, but not a central role, in terms of advancing some of the issues that I've described. But what has been central, however, are the moral claims that underlie notions of human rights. And these have been used by this movement to sensitize and to change public opinion, both in the North and in the South. And so what we see, what I would like to pose as a challenge is that we work towards a reformulation of human rights claims from one of individual entitlements to one of institutional responsibilities. And yet we also have to face political reality. The contemporary political context is one where we cannot avoid the fact that human rights now, notions of human rights, are used to justify wars or what are called humanitarian wars, or what are called wars of liberation, or wars of bringing democracy to Iraq and other places. We also cannot avoid the fact that some key intellectuals who have been extremely important in terms of promoting notions of human rights are in fact promoting notions like torture light. And I'm thinking, for example, of Michael Ignatieff, who's been a major force, intellectual force, in terms of promoting an understanding of human rights. And yet he's now in a position where he's publicly saying that torture in some circumstances and under very specific, in very specific contexts, is okay. Now, those kind of claims, in a way, diminish the power of human rights arguments. And yet, at the same time, they challenge those who claim a human rights discourse to reclaim that discourse, and in fact to do so in a way that is significant in terms of practical day-to-day problems. And so we also can't avoid the fact that we also can't avoid the fact that the context where rules are made and then ignored is one that exists largely through the actions of the strong. And I'm thinking, for example, of the creation of the WTO itself. The WTO was created largely by the trade interests of Western business, which lobbied Western governments to create an institution that would codify a global free trade regime. Part of that was the TRIPS agreement, or the Trade and Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. That agreement, and there's not much contestation around this, that agreement was largely written by the pharmaceutical industry and then promoted and brought into law through the lobbying efforts of the American government. And then we also see that even with a free trade agreement, a global free trade agreement, bilateral pressures and trade sanctions and so on are still brought to bear by the Americans and also largely by the EU when specific trade issues are not in the interests of their corporate constituencies. And these are the political realities that we have to deal with, or that we have to face in terms of trying to advance the notions that we're talking about. So let me just conclude by saying that we have seen significant changes at the WHO, for example. We've seen the creation of a new institution, the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria. We've also seen significant political declarations at the WTO. And in my view, these kinds of changes can be advanced using a human rights discourse that demands institutional responsibility in the realization of human rights. And that that is a core challenge. And we can do, the point of doing this is to create at a global institutional level a counterweight, if you will, to the power of an organization like the WTO, which is the most powerful institution, a global institution in the world, simply because it is the only global institution in the world that has an enforcement mechanism and an enforcement capacity, and a capacity to actually impose enforcement decisions. In pursuing this kind of approach to human rights, it can redefine a new normative structure to rein in, if you will, the negative effects of bilateral trade agreements and regional and growing now growing regional trading blocs. And I think if you look at the actual charter itself, and the UN Charter, the UN Declaration on Human Rights, there is an article that deals specifically with the issue that I'm trying to put forward here, and that's Article 28 of the Declaration. And the article says, everyone, and this is actually in the Charter, or in the Declaration, everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this Declaration can be fully realized. And this, in practical terms, is what activists have been doing over the last 7 years. And what I would like to see happen over the course of our deliberations, not only tonight but also over the weekend, is an active engagement of some of the concepts that, for example, Thomas Pogge will present in a few minutes, that are extremely compelling ideas and extremely compelling arguments as to why and how moral claims on institutions around the realization of human rights can